Okay, let's get started. Je crois que ce sont les écureuils qui ont le mieux compris. Il faut dormir du début de l'hiver jusqu'à la fin. C'est comme ça qu'on peut s'en sortir. Mais puisqu'on n'a ni la Constitution ni le droit, on va continuer l'histoire de la Grande-Bretagne. So, welcome to week 11. So, just this week and next week left, I'm going to talk to you today about two or three big movements during the 19th century, so I am abandoning the chronological approach. We have a theme today, which is radical movements and the move towards democracy, very, very slow move towards democracy. And next week, I will be talking about the British Empire. And I mustn't forget that next week I will give you the homework. Yeah. Okay. Right. So, where are we then? Yeah. The first thing we think of when we think of the Industrial Revolution is the new machines, the new technology, the new science. But also, I told you that it's important to remember the other big changes, the new financial tools, the banks, the modern bank. Very important. The new organization of social life. Everybody to the towns. Yeah, the very modern idea. Yeah, everybody in the towns. Very strange idea at the time. But also, the Industrial Revolution invents many more things. For example, in the 19th century in Britain, the modern trade union is invented. And this is very surprising for people at the time, trade union, syndicat. This is very surprising for people at the time. It's a new idea, and most people, this is a surprising idea. What shall we do with the trade union? Some people say, we need to replace the fact, we're a trade union, we need to replace the factories, because the factories are too hard, life is too hard. We need to build our own factories, separate factories, and organize life differently. That's one idea. Another idea is, no, we don't need to do that. What we need to do is to fight for the right to vote so that we can vote for a government which will help us by passing laws. A second idea. And there are many more ideas, some of them a little bizarre. And very slowly, you see the development of the modern trade union, which is sometimes we negotiate and sometimes we strike. Yeah, what do unions do? Negotiation most of the time and from time to time a strike. That they deal with the boss and they try to organise the people who work. And so the modern trade union does not say we need to replace the factories, build our own factories. No, that's not a modern trade union idea. That's a 19th century idea. But what is surprising about trade unions is when they began, they were very unusual animals. And people said, oh, what's that? Whereas today, in every country in the world, except one or two very horrible dictatorships, you have trade union movements in Australia, Japan, in China now. And so there is something logical about trade unions in modern industrialized society. It seems to be almost inevitable. There are no modern industrial societies which do not have trade unions. But this was a new idea at the time. Okay, so let me look at some of these movements. And I have some particular dates to start with. Some symbolic dates. 1830, Captain Swing. 1832, the First Reform Act. And 1838 to 48, Chartism. Here are my three themes for today. And also, I hope to have time to talk a little bit about women's rights, because although I think you understand that rights for everybody were pretty low in the 19th century, it was even harder for women who had very little rights altogether. So, what are these key elements up there? Yes, good. Nice hat. 1830, first of all, Captain Swing. Let me summarise Captain Swing in a few sentences. Captain Swing is a big movement of agricultural workers, of people who don't have land, but who work for other farmers. It is very surprising because it goes across the whole country, little by little, or the whole of the South, and the whole of the South, that the revolt of Captain Swing goes from county to county. Mostly, this is a movement in the villages of agricultural workers. And very impressive because, of course, agricultural workers, most of them cannot read and write. Okay, most of them cannot read and write. Of course, they cannot use Facebook to mobilise. Yeah, there's no Facebook in 1830. And so a surprisingly widespread movement of agricultural labourers. What do they want? First of all, higher wages. Secondly, they want to eliminate the use of certain machines which mean that they don't have so much money. Il s'agit des batteuses, parce qu'il faut battre le blé. Ce n'est pas amusant de battre le blé, mais ça permet de gagner du fric à un moment de l'année où il n'y a rien d'autre à faire. Hein. So when the machines came in with water power or steam power, the agricultural workers were very unhappy, very panicked, and so they had a campaign against these machines. But it went much further, and little by little, they also campaigned against the tithes. La dîme, les impôts qu'il faut payer à l'église. Okay. And they went round to see the vicars. Hello, Father, Mr. Vicar, yeah, the priests. And they said, you receive from the village, I don't know, £50 a year. It's too much. We don't want to pay so many taxes to the church. We want you to reduce it. The first one, higher wages. Sorry, the first one, what? First one, what? Yeah, there was higher wages, stopping some of the new machines, reducing taxes paid to the church. Now, this is an interesting... Oh, and, of course, the method is... Hello, Mr. Vicar, would you like to reduce your taxes? No. I am coming back tomorrow with 1,000 people. We think you will change your mind. Okay, it works by intimidation. There are no elections, you cannot vote, you don't have a lot of options. Yeah. Oh, look, your house has burnt. Have you changed your mind now? Yeah, okay, it's collective bargaining by riot. It's the only option at the time. Notice, interesting thing here, the Captain Swing movement campaigned for reducing the taxes paid to the church, but not to abolish them. Oh, no. Everybody is a Christian. There is no campaign against the church. It's impossible to imagine to campaign against the church. But campaigning against too much money being taken by the priests, etc. Number four, campaigning against the rents. Le loyer pour ceux qui payent, who pay a rent for the houses. So, quite general demands, slightly different in every village, and a very powerful movement from one village to another village to another village to another village. Meetings, intimidation, burning, etc. Why Captain Swing? Captain Swing is the name of the imaginary leader of this movement. Yeah. Just like Robin Hood, Robin des Bois, who was probably imaginary. Why an imaginary leader? Because, of course, a real leader would be arrested and probably executed. So nobody wants to... I'm the leader! No. Yeah. So you have a secret... It's not a real leader, it's an imaginary leader. And one of the ways we know about this movement is we still have the letters. There were letters received by people who had the machines, the threshing machines, letters received by priests, and they were all signed Captain Swing. Of course, who does not exist? Yeah. Every group signs it Captain Swing. Now, why Captain Swing? Well, captain, of course, an idea of authority, and swing, well, it's a kind of black humour. Yeah, what will happen to them if they are arrested? Swing, yeah, pendu, c'est un peu capitaine pendu. So it's a kind of joke, yeah, sort of black humour about what would happen. And the Captain Swing movements, so very big movements, based in the villages, not in the towns. Probably the last movement based in the villages in Britain. The villages are going down and down. The towns are going up and up. And if you go to England today, fundamentally there are no villages in England. You come out of one village and you're in the next village. There is no space. Scotland is different. Ireland is different. But in England, villages. I don't know anybody who lives in a village. Whereas in France, of course, you still have a lot of villages. Well, not near Créteil, but a bit further out, yeah? If you get beyond... Never mind. Okay, I know you're very urbanised people. That's good. Villages are very boring places to live, I think. Okay, so Captain Swing movement. 1830 is also the date of one of the revolutions in Paris, the Journée de Juillet. Yeah, and so these ideas are around, it helps, it all gives an atmosphere of revolts. But that is a particular example. Let me move on to the second element, the 1832 First Reform Act. Of course, today we call it the First Reform Act, but its name at the time was the Reform Act. Because there was no intention of having a second one. Now, we now know, in reality, there was a second Reform Act in 1867, and there was a third Reform Act in 1884. J'ai même pas besoin de mes notes, c'est fou ça. But this is the first one. Now, the first Reform Act is, in reality, a very small change. I have the statistics here somewhere. Yes. Before the 1832 Act, 450,000 people could vote. 450,000. 450,000 people could vote before. And after the Great Reform Act, that is on the officiel, 700,000. That is to say, after the reform, one adult in every 14 could vote. It's not very impressive. Yeah? After the Reform Act, one man in every 7, and no women, could vote. So, we are not talking about democracy here. We are talking about having a bigger base for an oligarchy. Now, this is not surprising, because at the time, democracy was an extremist idea, an idea only for extremists. Yeah, if you look in the Times, in fact, you can do it now. You can look in the Times for the word democracy, and you look at, and it's the word is extreme, yeah, etc. It's not considered to be normal. It's difficult for us to imagine, because today, although we are very unhappy with our government in general, we're often unhappy with our government, we consider it normal that everybody's opinion is important, and so everybody, approximately everybody, can vote. But at the time, this is very, very difficult for members of the elite to imagine. Many famous authors, for example, Anthony Trollope, who is a wonderful novelist from the 19th century, he wrote great, really very, very good novels, an important, intelligent man, completely opposed to democracy in every form. because he believed, as most people believed, that the hierarchy, the social hierarchy, was natural. It was natural. There was no reason for ordinary people to vote because ordinary people don't have a brain. That's really the idea behind it. It is rather difficult for us to imagine. Okay, so the first big change is in 1832. But we have to go back into history a little bit because the first question I want to ask is, why was there no change before 1832? But first of all, a little description of the system, the election system before 1832. I mentioned a little bit last week that the system had not changed for a long time. And in particular, we have two phenomena which are typical of the undemocratic and rather corrupt old method. The first one is the rotten boroughs. A borough, c'est une circonscription. Non, ce sont une circonscription. Some, il y a des circonscriptions pourries et des circonscriptions que quelqu'un a dans la poche. Sometimes a town which had a member of parliament, over 200 years, it becomes a very small village, but it still has a member of parliament. The extreme example is a village with seven houses and one member of parliament. This was a real example. Meanwhile, the towns which had become very big very quickly, Sheffield, Manchester, very often they had no members of parliament because they had no historical right to it. And a pocket borough means that the electorate is controlled by one person. Remember, if you are lucky, so 450,000 people had the right to vote. Bon, c'est pas que des milliardaires, hein, c'est l'élite, mais c'est pas que des milliardaires. However, how did you vote? In public, in front of the lord and the rich people of the area. It was not a good idea to vote the wrong way. Yeah. So the voting is in public, a small minority votes, and the voting is in public. So really, we can see the difficulties that here. So why was there no real support, no real change before the 1832 Act? Well, there were movements that wanted change. For example, after 1812, you have a series of clubs called the Hampton Clubs, and they want change. In particular, they want more members of parliament for the big industrial towns, the new industrial towns, the big industrial towns, the Hampton Clubs. And these are led by a certain Cartwright. And Cartwright thinks about this and he said, really, what we need is an alliance between radicals from the elites and the working class. We need a mass movement. It's not enough to have a small group lobbying and asking the parliament. We need a bigger organisation with people from the ordinary people as well. These groups established, the Hampton Clubs, established radical newspapers. Every radical movement must have a newspaper in every country, in every century. If you don't have a newspaper, you can't build a movement. For example, the Manchester Observer. What is amusing about the Manchester Observer is it still exists today. It's not so radical anymore. Black Dwarf, Le Nain Noir, Black Dwarf, was another radical newspaper of the time. These newspaper, Black Dwarf. These newspapers were very influential. Of course, many people couldn't read, but they had a solution for that, because they have a meeting, and one person will read the newspaper to the meeting. Yeah, that's unusual for us today, but that was the normal thing to do. And this movement for parliamentary reform came to a height in 1890. The movement for parliamentary reform was a rather unusual alliance. The middle-class radicals said, we want more members of parliament for the big towns, and we want more people voting. Some of the radical working-class people in the movement said, we want democracy. We want everybody to vote. The middle-class radicals not so happy with that. So it was an unstable alliance. But they decided to have a big meeting in 1819 in Manchester. They had a big meeting at St. Peter's Field. Si vous y allez, il y a un monument at St. Peter's Field. A big meeting for parliamentary reform. Come on the Sunday afternoon. And so there was Cartwright and other important people. And the local authorities were rather worried, and so they asked the soldiers to stand by. The soldiers were there to check. In the afternoon, the local magistrates decided that the town was in great danger, and so they ordered the police and the army to arrest the speakers. The crowd did not want them to arrest the speakers, and the soldiers attacked the crowd. So the soldiers attacked the crowd. This is August 1819. The soldiers attacked the crowd, and a number of people were killed by the soldiers. This was the big event at St. Peter's Field. I can't remember how many people, but a number of people were killed by the soldiers with their swords. And it has become famous under the name of the Peterloo Massacre. Now, why Peterloo? It's very simple. You remember the Battle of Waterloo, 1815. When Napoleon was defeated by the English in 1850, Waterloo. And so when there was this battle in St. Peter's Field, the journalist said, ah, Peterloo. Yeah, like modern journalism. So the Peterloo massacre. It was reported in a pamphlet called The Peterloo Massacre, which sold a very large number, and the government was rather embarrassed. Not so embarrassed, because the Home Secretary, the Ministre de l'Intérieur, wrote a letter to the magistrates in Manchester saying, congratulations, yeah, you were right. Yeah, so he was not too worried about people being killed. He thought it was necessary. And the people who organized the demonstration were arrested, tried, and imprisoned. So you could see that the elites were really very worried and very vicious repression because they were very frightened. This is still not so long, 20 years after the French Revolution. The elite is not feeling relaxed about this. So this is the first one big episode, 1819, Peterloo, one of the great English poets, Shelley, Percy Shelley, wrote a poem about Manchester, about the Peterloo massacre, called The Mask of Anarchy, La Masque de l'Anarchie, which is a little difficult to understand, but pretty good. After this, in 1822, during the 1820s, there were four different reform bills. Il y avait quatre projets de loi pour réformer les élections dans les années 20. None of them were successful. And in 1830, there was a new bill, donc un nouveau projet de loi. Et bien sûr, en 32, il va y avoir la loi, enfin. Okay, so in 1830 and in 1831, there were very big demonstrations and petitions everywhere in the country demanding parliamentary reform. The newspapers, the radical newspapers, became more and more popular. However, not everybody agreed about the usefulness of the reform bill. Rappelez-vous donc que le résultat final, ça va être de passer de 450 000 électeurs à 700 000 électeurs. So, in the radical newspapers, you have a debate. Somebody says, okay, the Reform Act, it's a small reform, but it's an important first step. Yeah? We want democracy, he wrote in the radical newspapers. We want democracy, but the Reform Act is a first step. And other people said, no. The Reform Act is not democracy. The Reform Act is a ridiculous, very small step. We are not interested. And so the radical movement is faced with a very classic problem, if you are a radical movement. What is an acceptable compromise? Yeah? If you have five demands and the government say, okay, you can have one, do you say, oh, that's good, it's a good first step? Or do you say, no, we're not interested, it's an unacceptable compromise? I don't know the answer to this question in general, but this is the question. Okay, so you had this debate. The government is in crisis. You have several different governments, un peu comme en Belgique aujourd'hui, big crisis. And finally, the Prime Minister, il s'agit du Lord Grey, Monsieur Grey, calls a new election, and the House of Commons approves the reform bill. However, of course, in Britain, you have the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and in 1831, the House of Lords refused. They refused to approve the reform. And so you have a blocked situation. And this is when the masses of people intervene. There are riots around the country against the House of Lords. So an interesting situation. In reality, this reform will not change the situation for ordinary people. It will move from 450,000 voters to 700,000 voters, and septième des hommes va pouvoir voter, même après la réforme. Et pourtant, ça mobilise les masses. Because people feel it is a first step. So there are big riots, especially in Bristol. 4 prisons are destroyed. In London, the houses owned by the Duke of Wellington and by a series of bishops, the people who had voted against the bill, the houses are burnt down. In Derby, in Worcester, and in Bath, there are a series of riots. On November the 5th, of course, Guy Fawkes Night, festival where normally they have fires, the people burnt models of bishops and lords. And so, remember, in the context where France is not very far away, and revolution is something which the elite are very frightened of, this was very, very frightening indeed. In Wales, there was a fight between the crowd and the army. 200,000 people went to a meeting in Birmingham. 200 000 personnes à un meeting à Birmingham. C'est fascinant comment ils faisaient les meetings à l'époque, parce qu'évidemment, sans micro, on ne peut pas parler à 200 000 personnes. Alors, ce qu'ils faisaient, c'est qu'ils mettaient en place une vingtaine de scènes tout autour d'un très grand champ, et chaque orateur parlera 10 minutes, et puis il va à 100 mètres, il parlera 10 minutes, tandis qu'un autre parlait ici. C'est comme ça qu'ils faisaient. C'est assez impressionnant. Okay, the slogan they had on these demonstrations was "More lords or none." That is to say, they asked the government, they asked the king, to create more lords so there would be a majority for reform in the House of Lords. Ils demandaient au roi d'adouber des lords supplémentaires pour pouvoir avoir une majorité dans la Chambre des Lords pour les réformes. Ou sinon, nous allons en finir avec la Chambre des Lords, c'est ça le slogan. More lords or none. Yeah, so, quite a radical thing. And in fact, the king agrees. The king says, okay, I will create new lords to have a majority for reform. But when the House of Lords, me too, when the House of Lords hears this news, they decide to approve the law. And so, the Reform Act is approved by the House of Commons and the House of Lords in 1832. So it was a long process from 1812 Cartwright, and last week I told you in the 1780s the county committees. 50 years of campaigning for a reform which in addition was quite a small reform. They moved from 450,000 voters to 700,000 voters. And this reform was only possible because of the intervention of a lot of people in the streets, if you like. It was not an ordinary law. For example, the king agreed to the law, but did not agree with the law. Je vous fais un petit test anglais là. Donc il acceptait de signer la loi, mais il n'était pas d'accord. Il était forcé. For example, he refused to come to the house. He refused to come to the parliament to sign the law. He signed the law in his house, so it was a symbol to show that he did not agree. So why was it possible, this law in 1832? Well, I think a significant part of the elite considered that the alternative was a situation like in France, a revolutionary situation. Yeah? That this is the best way to avoid a revolutionary situation. And indeed, many of the many of the supporters of this Reform Act said this is the best way to avoid democracy. Yeah? We clean up the system, we reduce corruption, we increase the number of voters. In this way, we can be sure, we hope, that it will stop here and there will be no more Reform Acts. It was a reasonable opinion. The second Reform Act is in 1867. That is to say, can you help me here? 35 years later. Vous avez bien fait de ne pas faire maths à la fac et de choisir lettre. Okay, yeah. 35 years later, the second Reform Act. 35 years is a long time if you are waiting for a bus or a reform. What's important about this is, I'm repeating myself, but it's important, the move towards democracy is not an automatic, inevitable advance. It's a very messy, complicated, confused, panicked advance. This is why you have to suddenly wait. Now, first Reform Act, wait for 35 years. Second Reform Act, wait for 18 years. Third Reform Act, why? It's because there's nothing automatic about it. It was very, very difficult. Now, the actual Reform Act itself was a rather strange compromise. The Prime Minister insisted that the Reform Act should not include the idea of the secret ballot. Donc le vote secret, ça c'était exclu. C'est le Premier ministre qui a insisté que ça ne rentre pas dans la réforme. Again, today we consider that secret voting is very important, very basic, you know. Rotten boroughs were abolished. Ils ont aboli donc 56 de ces circonscriptions. Pourri, c'est-à-dire qu'avec une poignée d'électeurs. And 100 seats were given to the new industrial towns. 100 members of parliament for the new industrial towns. However, a large section of the working class mobilisation were very disappointed. They said, oh, all this mobilisation, and what's the result? 700,000 voters across the country. Now, 700,000 voters, you might think it's better. Huh? If you live in an industrial town and your town has a member of parliament, even if you don't vote, at least you have somebody you can lobby, you can organise politics. It makes politics possible. If you live in an industrial town and you can't vote and there is no member of parliament for the town, it's even worse. So there is a beginning. It makes politics possible. But certainly the disappointments of working class radicals will lead to the next part of our story, Chartism. Okay, the first thing you will notice is j'ai changé les dates depuis une demi-heure. C'est pas parce que l'histoire a changé depuis une demi-heure. It's because there is no very clear beginning and there is no very clear end. But certainly for 10 years or 13 years, comme vous voulez, there is Chartism. And so let me talk to you a little bit about Chartism. Do you know anything about Chartism? C'est en Angleterre, oui. Yeah, anybody know anything about Chartism? Qu'est-ce qu'ils voulaient? Now, what did they want? No, they wanted something. Okay, so let's have a look at the story of Chartism. Chartism is a very... Well, first of all, Chartism is a movement which lasts for 10 years, or perhaps for 13 years. It's a big movement, a mass movement. And this is already exceptional. A mass movement which does not last 3 weeks, but 10 years, is something very new. Remember, the typical political activity of revolt is the riot. À l'époque, ce qui est typique, c'est l'émeute. Alors les émeutes, ça dure 3 jours. Hein? Peut-être une semaine. And that's it. So here you have a long-term, mass, working-class movements. And in fact, Chartism is the first national mass working class movement in the world.
Ce n'est pas surprenant que c'est le premier du monde, parce que quand on a la première révolution industrielle, on a le premier plein d'autres choses aussi, parce qu'ils vont avec.
Okay. It is the first national mass working class movement in the world. Captain Swing was national, but not working class. It was, not on the industrial working class. Luddism was not national. So here you have a national movement. It is the first movement to bring together economic and political combats. And one of the most important demands was the vote for everybody. Or at least the vote for all men. Ce n'est pas clair. Au tout début, on demandait le vote pour tout le monde. Et puis par la suite, c'était le vote pour tous les hommes. Ce n'était pas forcément un grand sujet de débat. L'idée, c'était un vote pour la famille. Dans l'ensemble, à cette époque-là, les chartistes femmes, il y en avait beaucoup, considéraient que l'essentiel, c'est que des gens ordinaires comme nous votent, que ce soit des hommes ou des femmes, this was not a big problem at this time. Now, you have a big, powerful movement, and people work very hard for 10 years or more because they want the votes. Now, this is already a little difficult for us to understand, because although today most people think it's good to vote, it's better to vote. At the same time, many people stay at home, and nobody thinks our lives will be completely transformed by the next election. Yeah. I think that it's very unusual. Of course, people think this government is better, or the next government will be better, yes. But nobody thinks, poverty will disappear forever after the next election. Nobody believes that. But remember, in this situation, at the time of Chartism, nobody had ever seen democracy, and people really believed, if we have democracy, there will never be poverty or hunger ever again. So it was a very, very big struggle, because they didn't know. Democracy certainly improves the situation tremendously, but it's not true that when you have democracy, poverty disappears. But they didn't know. One of the reasons that it is such a powerful movement is because they believed that the election, democracy, would be a complete change of society in every form, and that inequality would disappear. I have a quotation from one of the leaders of the Chartists. "We demand universal suffrage because it is our right, and because we believe it will bring freedom to our country and happiness to our homes. We believe it will give us bread and beef and beer." Okay, so really the idea is that if we have democracy, we will have happiness and plenty. Sounds good. The movement is very dynamic, very varied. There is a continuous debate about the best tactics, the best strategies, the best theories, the best analysis. There are a number of important newspapers, and in every newspaper there is a debate. Is this the best way to win democracy? Is this the best way? What should we do? And the newspapers are, in some ways, the organizer of the movement. Yeah. So I'm a Chartist. Here we have four people who are interested in Chartism. Okay. I have the newspaper. Will you sell some newspapers to your friends? Oh, no, I'm too frightened. It's too dangerous. Will you sell some newspapers? Okay, I'll sell them. I know who are the good leaders, the people who are brave enough to sell the newspaper. The newspaper organizes the movement because it allows you to test. It's very easy for people to say, I agree with your newspaper.
Will you sell it? Oh, no, I won't sell it. Yeah, so a very, very important test here. Okay. The context, of course, this is 1837. I mentioned the context last week. Extreme poverty. I just have one more example here. On the Sunday schools, the religious Sunday schools for children, the children, every week, the children gave one penny. Yeah, and maybe I mentioned this already. They gave one penny pour payer l'enterrement du prochain à mourir. Yeah, it's red, but that was the reality. Yes, because poor people everywhere in the world, very often the first priority is a decent burial. It's extremely important for people. So a very desperate situation. And in 1837, we have the first meeting, and they write the People's Charter. A small group of people assemble somewhere in London, and they write La Charte du Peuple, the People's Charter. Et vous savez, on a écrit une charte du peuple. Mais t'es cinglé, toi, vous étiez 12, oui, c'est ça? Exactly, there were 12 people got together, not very important people, very influential people, and wrote the People's Charter. They didn't know they were going to found the first national mass working class movement in the world. But they did what they could. So they wrote the charter in 1837, and it is a list of demands. Je n'ai même pas la liste là, ça c'est plus grave. What is the list of demands? I think I can remember them. Number one, the vote for all adult men. Ah, j'ai trouvé. Number two, votes must be secret. Those are very basic democratic demands. If the vote is not secret, that's not good. Yeah? Yeah. Secret. Number three, the abolition of property qualifications for members of parliament. Let me explain. The abolition of property qualifications. The situation at the time was, if you want to be a member of parliament, you must have 25 acres of land. Yeah. You cannot be a member of parliament unless you are rich, fundamentally. Property qualifications. Donc, l'idée officielle, l'idéologie officielle, c'est que les gens qui n'ont pas de propriété, quelque part, ils n'ont pas existé. Très souvent, ça l'est exprimé comme ça, c'est-à-dire que la masse des gens, s'ils ne possèdent pas un bout de l'Angleterre, comment ils peuvent vouloir voter pour le gouvernement? L'Angleterre, c'est de la terre. Et alors, c'est normal que ce soit que les propriétaires terriens qui votent. That was the idea, really the idea at the time. Okay, so, the People's Charter. Number one, the vote for all men. Number two, the secret ballots. Number three, the abolition of property qualifications for members of parliament. Number four, a salary for members of parliament. Now, of course, today, if you say, we need money for members of parliament, nobody's interested. But this is an important democratic reform. Because if members of parliament do not receive a salary, that means only rich people can be members of parliament. So payment for members of parliament is an important democratic reform. Number five, thank you. Equal electoral districts. Equal electoral districts. Des circonscriptions de taille similaire. Donc, pas un député pour un million là-bas et pour seulement 1 000 ici, mais en général, circonscriptions logical. And the last one, very last one, elections every year. Annual elections. Je vais vendre la mèche. Although at the end of the Chartist movement in 1850, the demands are not one. All of the demands, except one, will be effective before 1911. Donc le mouvement, pendant qu'il existe, il ne gagne pas ses revendications. Et ça ne marche pas. Cependant, l'ensemble de ses revendications passent quelques décennies plus tard, except for one, annual elections. Okay, annual elections. Okay, so suddenly you have this movement for electoral change. One of the reasons for the movement was that life was very, very difficult at this time for trade unions. Because in the 19th century, at least, if you want a better life for working people, there are two possibilities. You organize trade unions so that your boss will give you higher wages, or, and or, you organize to have democracy so the government will protect you, you hope. And very often, the focus of the movement will go trade unions, democracy, trade unions, democracy. And in 1838, life was extremely difficult for trade unionism. A group of strikers in Glasgow were transported to Australia, not on holiday, in prison. And trade union, it seemed impossible to organize trade unions. And so people said, oh, well, let's work on a movement to have the right to vote. There was a massive meeting in London, and the movement began. Local newspapers, local groups, local meetings. In many parts of town, there were Chartist groups and Lady Chartist groups. Chartist groups for men and Chartist groups for women. This is because at this time, it is socially impossible to have a mixed political meeting. It's not possible. Yeah. The women would not come because either they would find it indecent or they would be frightened of their husband or father who would find it indecent. And so the solution of the Chartist movement was said, okay, well, we will have separate meetings for men and women. In this way, the women can be in the movement and although perhaps their husbands or fathers will not be very happy, their husband or fathers will say, okay, you want to go to a political meeting with other women, oh, okay. Yeah. It's possible. Whereas you want to go to a mixed political meeting, it was too hard. Yeah. So you have, sometimes the women Chartist groups were more radical than the men Chartist groups. So a lot of meetings, big. And from the very beginning, there were two strategies. These are not fixed groups. They are different sets of ideas. Because Chartism allows, for the first time, really, a massive debate about how can we change the world. So, in some ways, it's like the first political party, the first mass political party. But, of course, it's not focused around elections because they don't have the votes. But it's like a political party in the sense that they debate all social questions. And the two big groups, or the two big ideas within Chartism from the very beginning are moral force Chartism and physical force Chartism. This is not a question of violence or not violence. Dans le discours politique aujourd'hui, on juge très souvent les mouvements. Est-ce que c'est violent ou pas violent? Violent ou pas violent? Quand vous vivez dans un siècle où la moitié de vos enfants sont morts avant 10 ans, la question de violent ou pas violent, c'est pas la priorité. Hein? Nobody, that's not what it's really talked about. The idea is moral force or physical force. What is moral force? The people who defend moral force Chartism are saying we can persuade the elite.
we will go to the lords and the king and we will persuade them that democracy is better for everybody. And so what we need to do this is demonstrations, books, pamphlets, petitions, and this will be enough. The people in Chartism who says, no, physical force is what is necessary, say it is necessary to frighten the elite. They will never give us democracy unless they are frightened. And so what do we need to do? Well, many different ideas. The most popular idea is strike, refuse to work. They sometimes call this a grand national holiday. Let's organise a grand national holiday until they give us democracy. Another section said, no, that's not possible. What we need is we need to get guns and practice and become a military force. In reality, at this time, it was extremely difficult to organise a military force. And when they try to organise a military force, it is rather ridiculous. But this is the debate. Everybody agrees we need petitions and meetings and demonstrations and newspapers. Some people think we need strikes, a lot of people. And some people think we need a military option. Okay, so there's big debates going on all the time. In a few towns, the Chartists begin organising military preparation. So, what happens next? Well, in 1839, you have the first Chartist petition. More than 1 million signatures. And you can imagine, donc plus d'un million de signatures sur la première pétition des Chartistes. And you can imagine the moral force people are saying to the physical, you see, we have 1 million signatures on a petition. I told you, moral force is the best. And the physical force Chartists are saying, moi, peut-être. Okay? This is now 1839. And so they arrive in the House of Commons in 1839 with a petition, with 1 million. On dit 1,280,000, non? Okay? And inside the House of Commons, one member of Parliament said, I propose that we discuss the petition. 46 members of Parliament said, yes, let's discuss the petition. 235 members of Parliament said, no, let's not discuss the petition. Okay, so they arrive at the Parliament with a petition of 1 million signatures, and the massive majority of the House of Commons say we don't want to discuss it. Now the moral force Chartists are saying, oh, merde. And the physical force Chartists are saying, ça fait bien dit, hein? Okay, so the debate continues. Later the same year, in November 1839, 15 or 20,000 workers, Chartists, with some guns, organised a rebellion in South Wales, in Newport, the Newport Rebellion, the Newport Insurrection. So the physical force Chartists are saying, yeah, this is, yeah, you see, if we have an insurrection in Newport, then in other parts of the country they will follow and we will have a revolution. And the moral force Chartists are saying, well, I don't think so, but our petition was no good, so maybe. Yeah, that problem? Yeah, okay. From a military point of view, the Newport uprising, from a military point of view, was ridiculous. They were badly trained. They had no real leadership. They had very little. They had very little discipline. 30 people were shot. 500 were arrested. 6 of them were sentenced to death. But in fact, nobody was executed. The government was not so confident. If we execute people, it might set them off again. So, have this difficult situation, yeah? First of all, the big petition, failure. Secondly, the military uprising, ridiculous. It was a hard time to be a Chartist in 1840. However, the movement did not disappear. It continued for several years, and there was a... excusez-moi, j'ai oublié un épisode. 3 years later, you get the next important episode in 1842. And in 1842, there is a strike, a big strike in the north of England, and to defend wages, il y avait des réductions de salaire, alors il y a une grande grève. And the strikers decided to call a general strike for the charter. So they began the strike because of the wages, and then they declared in a big meeting, we are going on strike for the charter. And so you have Chartism and trade unionism together in 1842. Extremely powerful movements. For example, the strikers put pressure on shopkeepers. They said, all of our supporters will only buy from shopkeepers who have the charter in the window. Yeah? We refuse to support shopkeepers who don't. In fact, they said, many shopkeepers can vote. Beaucoup de tenanciers, des épiciers, tout ça, des petites entreprises. A lot of these people can vote. We cannot vote, but we buy from their shops, so we help them to live, so now they have to support us. It lasted several weeks. The national leadership was arrested. The government wanted to send soldiers from London, but when they got to the railway station, they found there were big demonstrations to stop the trains going north with the soldiers. Many soldiers refused to shoot on the crowds. However, it wasn't. It only lasted a few weeks, and after 4 weeks, most strikers had gone back to work. They won better wages, but they did not win the charter. From 1842 to 1848, you have a series of new ideas which dominate Chartism. The situation is difficult. The big petition was not successful. The military uprising was not successful. The strike won some wages but did not win the charter. What can we do? Debate continued within the Chartist movement as to the best way forward. There were many different ideas, probably 20 or 30 different ideas. I'm not going to explain 20 or 30 ideas, it's too many. I will explain four of the options. These were the ideas suggested. Here's the first one, the land plan. The land plan, it's a very simple idea. Okay, we are all industrial workers in Manchester. And what we do is, if you join the land plan, every week, you give the land company sixpence. Every week, sixpence. When we have enough money, we will buy a little farm in a village, and we will have a lottery. Ah, you won. You are now the owner of this little farm. Okay? And we continue collecting money and transferring workers into a little farm where, you know, you can live... more healthy because
Yeah, here in Manchester, life is really very, very difficult. And secondly, you will always have food. You're in a farm. Isn't that wonderful? Okay. Now, some elements of this plan are rather naive, as we will see. Nevertheless, it was very attractive to people who worked in the factories and said, so my grandfather was a farmer. He always had something to eat. This might not be true. This was the impression they had. And so this was the land plan. They tried it. The government was very angry. The government was very angry. They didn't like this idea. But this was the land plan. Vous pouvez poser une question, hein? Vous avez le droit. D'accord. Travail efficace, là. Bravo. Okay, so it seemed a good idea. This also shows a very modern debate. What do you do in a society where life is too hard? Do you try to escape from the system or change the system? It's a choice. The land plan is fundamentally a plan to escape from the system. Whereas the original charter was an idea to change the system. These are questions which still exist today. Is it better to escape from an unjust system or to change it? If there is an easy answer, I don't know what the easy answer is. But the Chartists posed some very modern ideas. It was not very successful from a practical point of view. First of all, on peut le tester. Si vraiment on vous envoyait sur la petite ferme, ça marcherait? What do you know about agriculture? Not a lot. This was the problem. In reality, the factory workers did not make good farmers. Yeah. Maybe not quite as bad as university students, but nevertheless, pretty bad farmers. Yeah, it was not very successful. Secondly, of course, the population is so big, it is impossible to send millions of people back to the villages. It was not a practical option. However, it did allow the Chartists to debate publicly the bad living conditions of the working class. Here are three more options. These were smaller options, but nevertheless quite popular. Temperance Chartism. Temperance Chartism, c'est le chartisme anti-alcool. What they said is the most important problem of the working class is alcohol. And so what we need to do is to persuade workers to stop drinking alcohol. In this way, first of all, people will have more food to buy food. And secondly, we will show the elites that we are capable of, that we deserve democracy. Okay, now, this is difficult for us to understand today. Nevertheless, remember at the time, when you talk about alcohol, c'est l'absinthe, ou l'équivalent anglais de l'absinthe. It's not your desperado. Yeah? Yeah? No, this is real alcohol, yeah? So the idea that alcohol was a major enemy of the working class was not a ridiculous idea. Now, many people did not. There was a big debate. Many people did not agree. But it was not so ridiculous. Si vous imaginez aujourd'hui une campagne contre la drogue dure, c'est plus dans ce sens-là qu'il faut le voir. Hein? Yeah? Okay. Okay. So that was one option. Thousands of people were interested in temperance chartism. Second idea, education chartism. These chartists said what we need is independent schools
organized by workers for the children of workers, so that the next generation will deserve democracy. And they established a number of schools. The schools were very progressive. For example, in the Chartist schools, there was no physical punishment. Il n'y avait pas de punition corporelle, ce qui à l'époque était absolument incroyable. In some of the schools, the girls and the boys studied the same subjects, which was extremely progressive at the time. Finally, church Chartism. Some of the Chartists said, we need a new religion. And they established Chartist churches. They said, Jesus, if you look in the Bible, Jesus defended the poor. But the church in England, they are, look at the bishops, they all voted even against the first Reform Act. The bishops in England today are against democracy. But Jesus was on the side of the poor. We need a new church. And they established a number of Chartist churches. Okay. Again, today, if you are very angry about injustice, you wouldn't normally say, oh, I'll found a new church. This is not the standard reaction. But let's say that Chartism for the first time allowed a very wide debate about a lot of different possibilities as to how to change the world. And many of the people who built the trade union movement in the 1860s, the 1870s and afterwards began in Chartism. So Chartism taught a whole generation of people who wanted change about organising and about debates. The final episode, the final mass episode of the Chartists is the last petition of the Chartists in 1848. Now, 1848 is a year of revolution in France, in Austria, in Italy, in other places. So 1848 was the last big petition of the Chartists, which was even bigger. And the elite were very worried indeed. The Queen left London when the demonstration was organised. However, at the last moment, the leaders of the Chartist demonstration decided not to march on Parliament. They had announced that they were going to march to the Parliament, kind of insurrectionary idea, and they cancelled it at the last moment. And Chartist movement quickly declined. En fait, la pétition de 48, c'est la troisième pétition, parce que je vous ai parlé du premier en 1839, mais il y avait une deuxième qui est moins importante, mais qui est... Okay, so that is the end of Chartism. And like I say, the question that people always ask, or historians always ask, is was Chartism a success? And this is one of these very difficult questions. If the question is, did Chartism win its demands, then the answer is no. However, certainly Chartism changed the possibility of political organisation in Britain, and all of the Chartist demands except one will be won in the next in the following decades. You also have a series of leaders of the Chartists who are very colourful figures. I just want to mention a couple of them. You can check them out on Wikipedia. You have Rodter O'Brien, William Cuffey, Fergus O'Connor. These are three of the most important Chartist leaders. Fergus O'Connor and Brontë O'Brien, vous voyez un peu de leur nom de famille, are Irish. So it's interesting that the Irish should be so important. And William Cuffey is rather exceptional because he's an important leader of the Chartists, and he was black. Not a lot of black people in England at the time, but one of them was a leader of the Chartist movement. Okay, I have one last story to tell this morning. That's the end of the story about Chartism. And 1848, c'est pratiquement 1850 qui est la fin de notre période. So I'll stop with Chartism there, and I just want to look at one different question briefly, and this is the question of the situation of women in Britain in the 19th century. I got you some dates here, just to keep us in focus. So. This is a period when, as a general rule, almost everybody accepts that the social role of women and the social role of men are naturally different. So, ce qui me rappelle, je peux avoir une feuille de présence. Quand on regarde l'histoire, il faut faire attention à ne pas projeter dans le passé ce qu'on pourrait imaginer aujourd'hui. Le 19e siècle n'est pas rempli d'hommes machos et de femmes féministes, du tout. It is generally full of men and women who consider that men and women have different roles. In general, certainly, life is harder for women. I think that's true. But this is not generally contested by anybody, men or women. Yeah, so you have to be a little careful with this. C'est un petit peu comme la question de la violence. C'est notre préoccupation aujourd'hui. Il ne faut pas trop le projeter vers le passé. Okay, so here you just have some dates just to introduce the question. Now, at the beginning, some of these dates are of publications. Quand il y a simplement une date et puis quelque chose entre guillemets, c'est que c'est un document publié. Because at the beginning, the only possibilities for questioning the inferior position of women are writing a book. So the first protesters are intellectuals who write a book. For example, in 1659, Anna Maria von Schumann, who writes whether a maid may be a scholar. Est-ce que c'est possible pour une femme d'être intellectuelle? Alors, dites-moi, faut trouver que c'est ou non? Okay, yeah. So in 1659, this is a very progressive idea. In 1694, you can see that there is a woman who is writing a proposal to defend the interests of ladies. Now, if it says ladies, this writer is probably only interested in the women from the elite. But it's a beginning. 1792, Mary Wollstonecraft writes a vindication of the rights of women. So that's a very strong book about the rights of women. And it's not an accident that it's written in 1792, just after the French Revolution and the Declaration of the Rights of Man. Okay. However, as you can see in 1803, situation still very difficult. The Methodists, quite a radical religion, decide that women are not allowed to preach. In 1823, we see the first political example here. John Stuart Mill, a British philosopher, a man, and he is sent to prison because he is distributing pamphlets on birth control, the contrôle de naissance. At this time, to talk about birth control is illegal, even to talk about it. So every aspect, because it is considered to be contrary to God's law. Okay, so very, very difficult situation there. And a couple of years later, William Thompson and Anna Wheeler, who write The Appeal of One Half of the Human Race. So, an appeal of women. Nevertheless, what we are seeing here is documents.
pamphlets. We are not seeing movements of women. That's not possible yet. It was possible in the Civil War many years ago, because in a civil war everything is impossible. But there's no movements here, just ideas. More documents in 1837, 1838. And in 1839 you have a little reform that makes the situation a little better. A Child Custody Act. That is to say, if a man and his wife are separated, for the first time, some children will stay with the woman.
Rappelez-vous qu'il s'agit en fait des questions de l'élite. Des questions pour l'élite. En général, l'homme il garde les enfants pour avoir un héritier. Il ne va pas s'en occuper, il y a des serviteurs dans ça. Des domestiques pour ça.
Okay, so for the first time, it is possible for women, a mother to be given custody of her children under seven. However, the following year, jurisprudence, a judge defends a man's right to lock up his wife and beat her in moderation. Okay, so it is officially possible to. This is legally okay in 1840, but in the culture, it remains okay for a long time. I work on popular music at the beginning of the 20th century, and you have several songs which say it's okay to beat your wife. It's not shocking. It's not shocking at that time. I mean, it's shocking for us, but I mean, it was accepted. I mentioned last week about the Mines Act, where women are no longer allowed to work underground. And if you go down to 1847, you see for the first time a specific leaflet on female suffrage. A specific leaflet that says women should have the vote too. Okay. So this comes out of the Chartist movement. A section of the Chartist movement say it's not enough for men to have the votes. In 1848, you see the establishment of Queen's College in London for women who intend to teach. This is a difficult one because, of course, women who intend to teach come from the middle classes, not from the working class. If you're a working class woman, you can become a servant or you can get married. If you're a middle class woman, you can become a teacher or a prostitute. And that is really it. And so these first colleges established for women who intend to teach, very, very important. And in 1851, there is a petition presented to the House of Lords for women's suffrage, pour le droit de vote des femmes, suivi l'année suivante by the founding of the Sheffield Association for Female Franchise. So that you have the very beginning of a campaign for the women's right to vote, which will eventually be successful in 1918 for women over 30, and in 1929 for all women in Britain. And in France? Yeah, when do... 45, yeah? 1945 right, in France. Alors, n'oubliez pas de voter. Okay. Right, okay, we have a second example in 1856. You have a book about the property of married women. Because one of the big campaigns of the second half of the 19th century among women from the middle class was the right to own property. According to the law, everything you had belonged to your husband. And so you had some rather unusual situations where... If a man, there was an example when a man and his wife were separated, not divorced, that was almost impossible, were separated, and the woman made money by writing novels, and the man said, that's my money, and he received it. So this was one of the big campaigns. Okay, we have to stop there. I just wanted to make sure I didn't forget some of these important questions. Next week, the Empire.